Hey Tacoma, what's up? John Doherty here for Radio Tacoma's Climate Talk, the place where we talk about everything climate, always respectfully, ever striving to be fact-based, open to divergent perspectives, and always actively optimistic. Today we're going to do the second half of our conversation with Dr. Greta Turnbull. She's professor at Gonzaga University. Science and the scientific method are areas of focus for her. I think science is often misunderstood or distorted around climate change. I think one of the key problems is that we as lay people look at the world and how we decide what's factual in a very different way than do scientists. So that's a focus with Dr. Turnbull today. So here we go with part two of that conversation. Yeah, there's a behavioral economist named Dan Ariely that I admire. I admire the behavioral economists in general because they seem to be very practical people, and most of them got a sense of humor for some reason. Maybe you have to have a sense of humor to do that work. But yep. One of the things that Dan Ariely has said is that if we wanted to design a problem that human beings were uniquely ill-suited to manage, it would be climate change because it's got, I mean, psychological distance, large time, matters of time, hyper objects,
time biases, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, all that stuff. So just listening to you about this new generation that you're talking about, I could frame it a bit as, well, we're in kind of a race here.
You know, yes.
Is that generation going to come into power soon enough to address this? It also reminds me somewhat cynical quote that progress comes one funeral at a time. Have you heard
that? Yeah, I've heard things similar. Yeah. I mean, it's hard not to be excited when you work with the next generation. You know, every generation has the things that the previous generation sees as its blind spots, right? It's they're not perfect, but it's really, at the end of the day, you know, I work with 90 students a semester. It is really hard not to leave most days of work just filled with incredible hope and a lot of excitement for what our world is going to, how our world is going to be better because of them. They are incredible.
Yeah, I show up at public events like the Sustainability Expo, which happens in Tacoma once a year, well attended, and a lot of different vendors and other folks with tables there. And there are a lot of kids at this event. And I talk to kids that are in fifth, sixth, seventh grade. And at first I thought, well, I've got to explain to these kids what climate change is all about. But early on, you know, I was starting to kind of explain this and they're looking at me like, we know.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the mere knowledge of what's going on is prerequisite to addressing it. Until we acknowledge what's going on, then that's probably not going to happen. I'm just curious, are you familiar with a climate scientist, her work named Catherine Hayhoe by any chance?
No, I'm not.
Well, you would really enjoy her. She's at Texas Tech, I believe.
Okay.
But the reason that I find her so intriguing, you've made a couple allusions to religion. Catherine Hayhoe is an evangelical Christian, and she's a climate scientist.
Awesome.
And
Did she write in the New York Times, maybe? I think I've seen something from her.
She's well represented in the media.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure she's been in the New York Times more than once. The International Panel on Climate Change, she's one of the contributing scientists to that. She's got a lot of stuff on YouTube and so on. And so she is totally clear that there is no contradiction between her faith, which seems to be pretty profound, her husband's minister, an evangelical minister. And he's, you know, very supportive of her approach. So, and I'm just curious, of course, Gonzaga's a Jesuit university.
Yes, we are.
Once again, full disclosure, my oldest daughter is a graduate of University of San Francisco.
Oh, dear. Yeah, some rivalry there.
She got a fantastic education there. And I learned something about, a little bit about the Jesuit approach to life, education, and so on and so forth, and very much respecting it. So here's my question for you. As a professor at Gonzaga, do you ever feel any tug between religious values and academic values?
I don't hear at all. No, I wouldn't say that I do. And I am still someone who's a person of faith, and I have never felt like there was a sense of, I feel like at Gonzaga, if anything, I've grown in like my yeah, it's, I mean, the best part of Gonzaga is that we're here, the faculty are here to grow alongside students and staff. And so, and we take that growth incredibly seriously. I've been at other institutions before that were mission-based. So, you know, we had a mission that mattered to us. Gonzaga, that mission is in every classroom wall. We read that mission. It's in, you know, I could probably recite it if I started. Yeah. And that mission includes care for the environment around us. And so it's, I think that one of the gifts of Gonzaga has been working with students who see their lives of faith be like their work in social justice and their work to care for the environment be an outpouring of their life of faith, not something that is accessory to it, that is distinct from it. Like for my Gonzaga students, what it means to be a person of faith is to be someone who stands with the marginals. That's part of what that means. And someone who takes seriously the need for care for the environment.
Yeah, I think that's a beautiful perspective. And personally, I see that regardless of how I believe as an individual, this gift of the earth came to me, that I do have a responsibility, an obligation, really a joy to take care of it. My office overlooks the Tacoma Narrows, and I can see, today it's a beautiful clear day here, and I can see the Olympic Mountains, and I mean those are just sources of complete joy to me, and how we could not look at them otherwise is hard for me to imagine sometimes. So let's get back to a little bit of nitty gritty about science. So does science ever say that something is true?
Oh, that's also $1 million question, John. I think the best, the thing I love about doing philosophy of science is that I work, I'm attached to a evolutionary biology lab here at Gonzaga. So I get to hang out with them and I work with especially evolutionary biologists all over the world. And the best of them are the ones who say, you know, this is the best I've got on the information I've got, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I think that there are some scientists who will say, you know, what gets said by a scientist and what makes it to the media, it's like playing telephone, you know, that game where you whisper into each other's ear, who knows what comes out by the end of the chain of people, right?
Yeah.
So I think what gets reported in the media, there's a great John Oliver bit that I should talk with my students about. Where, you know, it's like chocolate is great for cancer. Chocolate is terrible for cancer. Red wine, you know, all these sorts of things. You can find news media saying that science says both of those things. So I think there's an incredibly leap pipeline between what science is actually saying and what the media reports saying. Now, I do think that there are some things in science that we have incredibly good evidence for, right? That we've accumulated evidence for, that we've done lots of replication on, that we can say is much more likely than not. As a philosopher, I get really queasy when we say more than that. But yeah, I think recognizing that that's the way science goes helps you respond when people have this thing in philosophy of science called the pessimistic induction over the history of science. And basically, it's like, look at all these things we used to believe it that were true in science that are utterly bankrupt, that are totally false, that we laugh at now, right? And that can range from things about race and gender that we used to believe that sexism and racism were scientifically backed, to things like ether. We used to believe in this thing called ether that does not exist, right? And so a lot of people, when you say, oh, science says this, then they will go to that list of cases in the history of science and say, well, wait a minute. You know, we used to believe that we used to believe in a geocentric universe. Like, right? That was crazy. And so I think that if we are able to say, look, science is actually, there are some things we have really, really good evidence for. Does it mean that all of it is 100%? Probably not, right? Then when we present that image of science, we're not surprised or we're not befuddled when we get some, you know, I don't know. I'm personally really excited to find out the new thing that science, science believes that we were totally wrong about. Like, I think that's something absolutely fascinating. But that doesn't threaten, I'm able to look forward to that because that doesn't threaten what I believe about science itself, because I have a view of science where science is about what's probable, probably more than true, or what we have on the evidence we have. I hope that we get all sorts of cool new. I work with paleontologists. I really hope there's another dinosaur dig out there that totally you know smashes all sorts of current hypotheses we have about dinosaurs. That would be amazing. I don't know that it's going to happen, but if it does, I don't think we're going to look back and think, "Oh my gosh, it was so dumb of us to believe in X and Y and Z in paleontology," because that was all we have on the evidence we have.
Yeah, so it seems like part of the cultural evolution we're going to have to do is expectations about what science can say and what science can't say. Yes. Because more of an approach towards, okay, we think this is probable, highly probable, and so on. Some people right now use that as a space to believe whatever the hell they want to believe. You might have seen this current movie, Don't Look Up.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's part of the theme of that is, well, as long as there's even 1/1000th of a percent
yes.
that this may not be true, that gives me the space to disregard it or so on. So it seems like we're going to have to evolve culturally to understand that. And of course, part of the problem there is that as we're pretty sure that, notice how careful I'm getting talking to you here.
Watch out. I know. Right. I'm really fun at parties. Yeah, that's right.
that our ideology tends to precede our conclusions.
Yes. Oh, and beautiful.
So
yes.
That if an ideology says, well, I don't want to believe this, or this contradicts my worldview, or I don't like where this has got us headed, then to look at the scientific approach of, well, we think this is probable, or the best information I've got is blah, blah, blah. So I guess we can just, all we can do is just sit and wait and talk and communicate with mm-hmm. our friends and mm-hmm. in other ways too, so on and so forth. So here's another question for you about science. So is it appropriate to ever say, well, there is a scientific consensus on this particular subject?
I think sometimes it is. I think we tend to be a little bit trigger happy with scientific consensus.
Okay.
We tend to deploy it pretty quickly sometimes. I also think the news media deploys it at approximately quadruple the rate that normal scientists do. I do think there are moments when it's appropriate. Like, I think we have consensus around evolution. I think we have consensus. I mean, I always use the example of gravity, you know, like, maybe someday we'll learn something new about the way gravity works. But it sure seems like since Newton, we've made some pretty darn good progress, right?
Yeah.
And most people, even people who are sort of take as part of their identity being science deniers, they're pretty darn happy with gravity, you know? Like we're seeing really cool, exciting new developments in cancer biology right now and immunotherapy. A lot of people are very excited about that, right? These less invasive treatments for a disease that is, had so much awful, incredibly awful effects on human history, right? And I think they're starting to build consensus around it. So I think it's also interesting. One thing that's been, I feel like, underlying our conversation is one of my heroes and like all of my life is Rachel Denhollander, who was the first woman to report Larry Nassar, the serial predator in USA Gymnastics. Mm-hmm. And Rachel is an incredibly deep thinker. And one of the things that she's really, reading her writing has really taught me is that she's talked a lot about how what we believe about the world and about people is really a function of what we care about a lot of the times. And I think that our image of science is scientists are perfectly objective. And then we hear about, you know, corporations getting involved in the clinical trials. And we say, wait a minute, I thought, you know, scientists were objective. What's going on here? That means we should distrust all science. But I think our image of what's human is involved in there, right? Like what it means to be human. And I think Rachel's right that a lot of times what you're willing to believe is determined by who you care about and what you care about. And so if we're willing to say, if we're willing to have a cultural moment of, oh, maybe we're not just like automatons that take in a piece of evidence and spit out a hypothesis. If that's not what's going on and we're actually really care about the environment and like maybe we're willing to try things and they're not going to work out to help the environment, but it was worth it because we cared and we wanted to be better, right? That to me feels like a more honest and more human way of interacting with the climate science than looking for it to provide these pronouncements that are 100% true all of the time.
Yeah. So I think that one of the problems with talking about scientific consensus is that ordinary folks, when they use the word consensus, I think that they're using it with a different meaning than we would in a scientific kind of environment. I mean, so the consensus is that the Ducks are going to win the Pac-12 this year.
I hope not. I'm a coon.
Hey, you're at Gonzaga.
Yeah, Gonzaga and a Coug. So
yeah, okay. Oh, that's right. You're a Coug too. I forgot about that.
Yes,
so
very important.
Okay,
we'll win it some year. Yeah.
Yeah, well, the guy that I work out with is a Coug, and so I tell him I'm a Cougar fan, except when they're playing the Ducks. So
okay, that's fair. I can take that.
So anyway, so do you see that's an issue, that what popular perceptions of a lot of these terms, not only consensus, but you know, probability and truth and proof and those things, that laypersons conclude that scientists mean the same thing when they use those terms?
Oh, absolutely. And I don't think we've done people any favors by not telling them, you know, that there's that great line from The Princess Bride, you keep using that word, but you don't know what it means. Right? And I think that happens all the time. I talk about that with my students all the time. I teach a logic class. And when they come into logic class, they use the word valid to describe something. For them, that word means legitimate, or something that I can recognize as legitimate, right? That's not what that means in logic at all, right? But they use those two words interchangeably, and then we get the two meanings interchangeably, and then we get something called equivocation, right? Which is a logical fallacy where we use a word that looks the same but has two different meanings.
Yeah.
We use it and we don't acknowledge that there are two different meanings going on there. And I think, to your point, I think a lot of times in the public, we use the word consensus democratically. Consensus means what we all came to agree on was best for our town, right?
Yeah,
which was to add new sidewalks or something like that, right? But that's not what it means in a scientific context. And again, I think that's something that as we, you know, this position of science communicator is growing, and I have friends who are philosophers of science who now work in science communication. I think that's something that we have a hope of that is going to get better. And I even ask my students I teach a 400 level philosophy of science class for non-philosophers, and I say, what is the image of science you're getting from text? And even their science textbooks are doing them no favors, right? Yeah. Like, their science textbooks are part of the problem a lot of the time. They're not part of the solution. So I'm also hopeful that we could start to talk about, like, the way that we talk about science, we wouldn't be in this defensive posture of always true, never makes mistakes, right? Mm-hmm. But that we would be in a posture of consensus means the best agreement we can have based on the evidence we have. That's way less, you know, that's way less, that looks way less solid, but I think it's way more honest and actually is going to serve us in the long run.
So let's take a little different subject here. So peer-reviewed journals, academic journals, literature, and so on, I think clearly play a critical part in understanding what's going on and bringing science to bear in an objective kind of way on what people's assertions are and so forth. So one of the problems I see is that there are credentialed scientists in legitimate peer-reviewed journals who say things about climate change. I mean, they're a tiny group for sure. Mm-hmm. They're a tiny group, but they say things. Willie Soon is one of the people that I think of when I think about this, because he's clearly a very well credentialed guy. And basically he asserts that human beings don't really have much of anything to do with climate change. So how does a layperson who's really trying to do a good job of understanding what's real and what's not, quote unquote, how do you deal with that?
Oh, I think it's so hard, right? And I think that's something we don't acknowledge. It's really hard to deal with that, right? Mm-hmm. I think it's very easy to sit in an ivory tower and say, well, all my friends believe, right? Like, all my friends believe in climate change. I don't have, you know, this is my point back to my students' social media page. I don't have any, like, all the, and one thing we talk about a lot is my students say, eventually, after you only see your beliefs in your community, like your community believes all the same things you do, then you think all the smart people think like I do, right? Because I'm smart, right? We always start from that assumption. I'm smart. And so now all the smart people and the educated people think like I do. And I had a student, John, who did an internship two summers ago, I think, in a rural area in the US. And he said, prior to going to that rural area, he judged them, right? Mm-hmm, he was like, how do you not believe in climate science? How do you not believe in the efficacy of the vaccines, the vaccine out? How do you not believe in the efficacy of masking? And he said he got there, and one day he was on a farm, it was a farm intern, and he had to drive a truck for like several hours, and he turned on the radio, and none of the programs that he listened were on that radio. There were only climate denying, vaccine denying programs. And he said it changed his entire world in a second, because he realized that those people in that community, it wasn't that they weren't intelligent, careful thinkers. It's that the news media didn't actually put in the resources to get them that, right? Yeah. So they were doing their actual absolute best to hear from all the experts, and all the experts were telling them climate science is false, right? Vaccines are dangerous for you. Masks don't work, right? And I always think about that when I think about talks like that, that experience he had, because I watched him change, and I also watched how he related to people change as he processed that. So I think a lot of it is how do we recognize that that's the reality? And I think that's a reality for, you know, geographically, a lot of the U.S., right?
Yeah.
And how do we not come in and say, oh, well, you should listen to our programs, right?
Yeah.
Because like we said, that's going to be a heck no moment for sure, right? It would be for you. It would be. And how do we have a place where science is a place where you can say, I think it's valuable that people can say, I actually don't agree with that consensus.
Yeah.
But if we actually understand consensus as a concept of the majority, right, of experts who are qualified in this field, then we don't see the minority as a threat. We see it as part of what science is, right? And sometimes the minority is right, right?
Like, absolutely,
sometimes the minority is right. And I think the more that I think there can be this tendency, especially among academics or academic adjacent discussion, to say, well, all we need to do is just get this information out to the people.
Right.
I think that would be great, you know? It would be great if you could hear NPR in every corner of rural America.
Yeah.
I don't think that's going to solution.
Yeah, you know, a little light just went off for me because, you know, in talking about being in an echo chamber or in your bubble or so on, I mean, I absolutely get that about myself. And one of the things I do work on disciplining myself to expose myself to ideas that are different than mine, you know, really distinctly different. And that's a painful process. I mean, it's hard for me to, it's like, you know, I've got this belief, this hope that we can pull through this climate change issue successfully as a species. And here's this voice out there that's got influence that's saying that don't bother with that.
Yeah.
So it's painful for me, but the light that went off for me is folks in this rural district who are all they're getting is, you know, COVID vaccinations are bad for you. Climate's not changing. Don't worry about it. I mean, it's painful for them too, to hear a contradicting message. So one of my takeaways from our conversation here is I'm going to be a little more gentle when I think about those folks. I wanted to toss into you. You mentioned, you know, there's this kind of bias like, well, you know, I'm pretty smart guy.
Yes. We always start with that one. That's always being step number one. Yes.
I don't know if you've ever come across it. There was a study done, and I'm not sure where or when, and I'm just sort of recalling in general terms the results of this study. But somebody went into a university faculty group, and they asked them the question. They said, do you think that compared to your colleagues, do you think you're below average, average, or above average in intelligence? Are you familiar with the study?
Yes, it's really depressing. And what did they show, John?
Well, my recollection is that the vast majority of people felt like they were above average when compared to the rest of their colleagues.
I mean, that's like what you're, you know, I always tell people, like, my job is, I love my job so much because I walk into work and I'm surrounded by brilliant, right? That's insane, right? That result is even more insane when you're like, most of the people in the rooms I'm in have PhDs, like, you know, like have studied for years, have made this their life. Their vocation is study. Like, we still think, oh, I'm better. I won't say it was very surprising. Like, I remember reading that study, like, oh, yeah, that makes sense of some of my experience in academia.
Well, you know, you used the word automaton earlier. We are not automatons, and we're not computers. And part of our task, I think, is acknowledging our humanness and our vulnerabilities and our biases and those kind of things. And of course, when I look at them, a part of me wants to rebel against all of that. So I just want to grab somebody and say, listen to me, can't you see what's happening here?
Yes.
And that's just guaranteed not to be successful at all. We're getting close to the end here.
Yeah.
Actually, it's been a long conversation. I've loved it, and I could do a lot more. Of course, you spend your entire thinking life, or most of you thinking life, thinking and talking about this. And I'm kind of envious of you, to tell you the truth.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's a good gig.
So there are other subjects we could talk about, but we are out of time. And so anything that you'd like to finish up with, something that I may have missed in asking you about, or whatever.
Oh, that's great. I think my main thought is the thing I do shake students and tell them to listen to me about, which is that the people that you disagree with deserve as much grace as you give yourself. And if you're not giving yourself grace, then that's a whole other problem, that you need to give yourself grace, right? Yeah. So the way that you treat the people whose beliefs fill you with ick, right? Who are like, oh no, I can't imagine, right? That's actually a reflection of who you are and how you see them, not actually necessarily always a reflection of them. Sometimes it is, right? There are people in the world right now who are very vocal that we should not stand with the people who are oppressed. That to me feels like above, you know, that's no, there's a line that crosses. Mm-hmm. But even those people are still people, right? Yeah. And so I think the solution, if there is a solution out there, it's going to be about recognizing that tendency in ourselves to see the people who disagree with us as less than human, and to like actively like own that in ourselves, and to move away from, like, to change that part of ourselves as much as in our control. And because it's something like, you know, you don't end up eating Lucky Charms every day just by deciding to do it once, right? You make decisions over and over again, right? To eat Lucky Charms for breakfast. And so it's going to be something that comes up over and over again. I see it in myself. I teach a class on this every single semester, and I still have moments where I come into that class that I'm teaching about disagreeing with people, angry and hurt and unbelievably sort of out of myself about something someone said to me because they disagree. That happens to me constantly. And I'm constantly having to go, oh my gosh, am I treating that person? Do I see them as an equal? Do I see them as a human being who has value independently of anything that they say? And I think the moments that I've seen for students when they're able, that person is a person, that's when actual societal change happens. It doesn't happen when they're like, let me give you this perfect argument, climate science, right?
Yeah.
And that's, it's hard. It's really hard. It's not easy. And that process is not a science. It's very bumpy. It's very windy, but it's definitely worth it.
Well, my takeaway from your closure there is science is there as a tool for us as human beings, but let's don't ever forget we really are human beings, we're all in this together.
Absolutely, John.
Okay, Greta Turnbull, Gonzaga University, it's been fantastic having you with us today. I've really enjoyed the conversation. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
So there you go with the conclusion of my conversation with Dr. Turnbull. As laypersons, as citizens, as voters, we have a real responsibility to develop thoughtful and fact-based opinions and practices, and Dr. Turnbull points us in that direction. I'm grateful that there are people passionate for building a livable world and our future, and I see Dr. Turnbull as one of those people who is living that vision in her daily life and being a positive influence on those around her. So many thanks for her time with us today. You can contact me at John, J-O-H-N, at cctacoma.org for comments on this program or to make suggestions for future programs. The CCL part is for Citizens Climate Lobby. I'm an activist with Citizens Climate Lobby. Check it out, a bunch of good people. Join up or find another organization if you aren't already attached to join your voice with others. This program, along with all other locally produced Radio Tacoma programs, can be found on the KTAH website under programming. So until we talk again, remember, always live like the mountain is out. Take care now.